episode number 82 of the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is a multi-talented individual who I'll get to in just a moment. First, I want to let you know that the Big Web Show is produced in association with HappyCog. At HappyCog, we connect you to your audience through websites and applications that balance beauty, strategy, and utility. Come and see our latest collaboration with Delaware Valley College at happycog.com. Ironically enough, I'm speaking to someone not from HappyCog, but from a competing and much larger studio, RGA. My guest today is Cindy Chastain, creative director and experienced strategist at RGA, also actress, screenwriter, freelance strategist, and mom, and probably 12 other things. So, Cindy, hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I don't think I'm sick today, which is nice.
Yeah, one of the few.
I know. Are you okay? Are you doing okay?
Yeah, no, I'm okay. You know, the kid has had some issues, but fortunately it hasn't seeped into my own, collection of antibodies.
Yeah, my kid too couldn't go to school today, although went after the
light. Oh, yeah. Alice went and she just got sent home, so...
Oh, no.
Yeah, they should go hang out and...
Did someone meet her? Because I see that you're at work.
Yeah. I think she went over to her dad's since I couldn't be there to free her. But so she's okay.
That's a juggling act right there that we could probably want to talk about. But let's talk about your career a little bit as a juggler. I recently discovered you're one of the stars of the movie Loveless.
I was wondering where you got that actress in there.
That's correct, right?
Yeah. I don't often sort of, let that one out into the open.
But it came out in 2011.
Yep.
There's a positive review at IFC. I imagine this played in like little theaters, art theaters.
Yeah, there was a small sort of, release at some theaters here and there. It also actually made it onto Time Warner On Demand, and it can be currently found on iTunes. It was one of those that tried to get into the festival circuit, didn't quite make it, but got sort of a minor distribution.
How much acting do you do?
Well, that was funny. That was complete anomaly. In the sense that it's nothing that I actively pursue. I used to, back in my film days, wanted to, direct and directed shorts and things like that. And so acting was something I always did in order to be a better writer and a director, actually. So I took classes for years because I enjoyed it. And I happened to run into two friends from film school. Where I got my master's in screenwriting on the corner. This is like one of those Hollywood moments in a funny way. And outside of the Starbucks in Soho, and we hadn't seen each other for 3 years. And he's like, oh, how are you? And they said, we're shooting a movie. And I said, oh, my God, that's great. And they said, did you know Andrew? Andrew is in this movie. And Andrew happened to be an ex of mine while I was in film school, still a good friend. And Andrew was the lead. And they had just... They were trying to find, they were in the process of casting this one role. And I think they had gone through a couple of like the soap star actress. Someone I didn't know. I think who else? There were some people that auditioned, but it just didn't work out. Maybe it wasn't a big enough part. And the role happened to be the ex-girlfriend of Andrew, who was actually my ex-boyfriend.
Right.
And I said, I can act. And I just raised my hand and they looked at me and they said, really? And I said, yeah, well, do you want to come over tomorrow and do, an audition? And I said, sure, that would be fun. And I did. And the end of the story was I ended up getting the part in this, it's a low budget film. And with people that I knew, friends that I had done. So it was like going to, 3 weeks of or 3 or 4 weeks of film camp to do this. And, it was fun.
Were you freelancing at the time?
Actually, I was not, but I ended up working out something with I was working at a small boutique agency. They're now called Canvas. They changed their name since then, but I would manage to find time to get away for this period to do this because it's like once in a lifetime. It'll be fun, and yeah, so we made it happen.
So you don't have huge hopes that you'll be discovered in this and...
Yeah, exactly. It's like that, throwing all this away because I'm hitting the road. No, I don't at all. It was really a great experience. I learned a lot. It was fun to be back in film in that moment. I was probably more interested in watching the camera person and set up the lights and all that. And it was also great collaborating with the director because we were collaborating on the story and the dialogue and the scenes. And so really there's no intention to quit my day job anytime soon.
It was a writing job too. It was a writing design, art direction, all that stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. So it's good to sort of like, do something creative in something that is part of my background that I used, love and hope to, return to when I get more time or at least integrate it more into my life. But that's.
And you're at RGA now, but you were at Canvas before. How many places have you worked as a, I know your title is creative director and experienced strategist now. How did you find your way from filmmaking into whatever it is that you do? What do you do?
What do I do now? I am a creative director sometimes is something that is not often found in the field of experience design. It's becoming more common because it's a title that's typically associated with, the old, traditional agency world. But what I think is good about RGA is they started a long time ago, I think before other companies started really doing this, including experience design, interaction design, whatever you want to call it, as part of the creative team. And it's always been a big fight because, there are designers who've been sitting within IT, been sitting in, all different contexts, but they wanted to elevate the practice as a creative endeavor. And so along with that, set up roles that were correspondent across other disciplines like copy and visual. And so, and what that means is essentially it's at a creative director level, you're setting the vision for a particular project. And if you're from experience design, often working on strategy as well. Not all creative directors are strategists, but that's something I guess bring into the mix, and working a lot with the clients and creating the right conditions for teams to do great work. So essentially it's more of a management position and a creative leadership position. I'm not sadly actually creating the designs as much these days. I create a lot of PowerPoints.
Well, sure. Going from at a certain point in your career, you're mostly hands-on, but not that strategic. And as you get more strategic, management also comes with that. I think one of the things that you do at RGA is try to break out of silos or make sure people can work across silos or that nobody thinks in silos, even if, that collaborations, the thing that impedes collaboration most of the time is that, you were just saying, a designer might be in IT and might be competing with a designer that sits in, in marketing or something.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And you instead you want to foster collaboration across disciplines and kind of get people out of those entrenched high-ceilinged cubicles.
Yep, I totally agree. And I think that's what appealed to me about coming to RGA in particular, because I think that's part of their core ethos. They talk about it a lot. They actually practice it. And a lot of the times when we, when I'm interviewing people about RGA and, coming in, we talk a lot about the blended teams.
What does that mean?
Blended team, meaning that, a visual designer is going to collaborate hand in hand with an interaction designer who's going to collaborate hand in hand with a developer. We try and build those structures in as much as possible so that there's not this waterfall of, handing over the work, that people are building solutions and they're making things together. And, it's not always people do have to go off and do focus on their core practice, but there's a lot of coming together and working things out in the room and making sure that we're getting the right people in the right room at the right time. We need an analytics person. And I think in today's world, collaboration is even more important because of the complexity of things. And so it's becomes an imperative and more of a challenge to make that happen. So I think it's really important that everyone is you know, looked upon as we're part of one team making something together. There's very little egos in this environment. It's not like, you know, who created the best comp or got the best idea out there and they win, sort of what you'd kind of find in a traditional agency world. You know, it's like, we all own this, you know, we know what, you know, you contributed and what you contributed, but no one needs to stand around and say, you know, hey, I did this. So in that sense, it's also very flat structure as well, because even though there are titles and positions, I've seen very few people who kind of throw their weight around in that respect.
Do you also feel like breaking away from set expectations about deliverables would help flatten the hierarchy and then foster collaboration? In other words, if one person has, you know, says, well, I'm doing the style tiles, and someone else says, I'm doing the comps, and someone else says, yes, I'm doing the wireframes, that kind of fosters a more, again, that's a kind of siloing of the process and a siloing of the creative project and the product. And but if when, you know, if it's kind of like in advertising, if the copywriter can write the headline and the art director can write the body copy, and you know, people can just contribute as they see fit, then stuff, rather than being harnessed to their discipline. Do you I'm not turning this into a question very well, but do you?
No, I totally get what you're saying. I get we do try and think about that. There's that always that tension between having to create a deliverable that a client expects that's in your SOW that we said we would get out to them, right? They expect we have wireframes and we're going to have comps. But when it comes down to actually creating things, I've seen lots of situations where we do a lot of collaborative sketching, which I think is also helpful. You get the designers in the room, you even get producers, you get, you know, developers sketching together. And sometimes we'll even, you know, there are instances where we'll go from a sketch to a visual design, right? And work things out together and kind of skip that step if we don't need that deliverable. If we do need the deliverable because it's really complex, there are a lot of requirements to capture, you know, the goal, and it doesn't happen every time because it's not perfect, but the goal is, you know, get input at the right times and then let the designer kind of go off and finish it, right? And make sure all the things that need to be noted are noted and all the details that need to be captured are captured. And then when we start to then turn that into visual design, there's another layer of iteration, another layer of, okay, we still have to work out, you know, some of the interactions and make sure it's all still laddering back to strategy. So there is always that tension. It's not perfect, but where we can blur them, I think it's great.
So it does sound like it's still a waterfall process, not as a negative, just as a description.
I think it's going to vary across companies, but and not companies. It's funny I said companies.
Yeah,
well, are the DAs like
it's like, so big?
It's a confederacy.
Yes. Okay.
And of states, you know, and I work on a state called Nike, and someone else works on a state called, you know, MasterCard. You know, so so there are different cultures and different. I mean, there's a common ethos, but it really depends on the type of work, right? And the appetite and the relationship with the client. And Nike, interestingly, is all about agile and agile development. And I know there are a lot of flavors to that, right? It's not everyone will say we do agile, but they could mean very different things.
Have you heard washing machine?
Yeah, I have. Okay, I haven't heard that in a while, though.
Yeah, I forget who invented that. It's sort of this mix of waterfall and agile where there's agile work and then there's some more traditional UX process that goes on and then back to agile.
It's funny. I totally forgot about that. And that's actually a really good term. I remember, do you know Livia Labate?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. I remember her talking about that a few years ago. I don't know if she came up with the term. It's so funny because I actually have a slide of some cycles. I wish, where it's like we're doing like design sprints that kind of feed into agile sprints, and it is very much like a washing machine. And because I do believe that for a lot of the stuff we're doing, especially things that we need to look at really holistically, like we need to kind of have an understanding not only the vision but how all these pieces work together. It's hard, I think, sometimes to do true agile because we need to have an understanding that's broader than maybe the component you're working on in this particular set of stories, right? So some upfront UX, the like planning, and I would call it even information architecture, I believe needs to be done that kind of feeds into that. And at a certain point, when you're really creating the interfaces and deciding what functionality is going to work or what we can, you know, leverage, then we try and work more agilely, more collaboratively, but it really is a spectrum. I mean, it's hard.
What size teams are you managing in these projects for Nike?
Personally, I'm working on a large initiative. It's, as we like to say, we're building a true functionally integrated ecosystem of products, applications. They're business tools. This has nothing to do with marketing. It's about tools that are going to help their global sales team get products to market globally.
Like a tool a customer might use in a store or a salesperson might use in a store?
That might come down the road, but right now it's Nike internal teams who are actually creating assortments plans for retailers. So it's be like a B2B, so retailer e-commerce, like the Foot Lockers and mom and pop sporting goods stores of the world who actually buy products to sell to their customers. And so this is, we're actually, they're replatforming. This is an unusual case. So we're building, I think we have right now 5 applications of different sizes. Some are really small, some are bigger and more complex, almost simultaneously. Because they're, and there'll be like V1 versions. And for that, we have a team of 7 interaction designers that are working together and independently, because we don't like to call them individual teams. We're one team that's trying to solve, you know, specific problems in the context of a much bigger problem. Does that make sense?
Yes. Are these, when you talk about 7 interaction designers, are these all people with different backgrounds? So one might be more of a coder, one might be more of a, you know, have a more visual flair or more of a stylist, one might be more of an IA background.
Totally. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it was not easy building this team. And I've always believed that in building teams, it's good to have a mix of strengths and areas of expertise, because no designer is built the same way. And not only at different levels, but they come from, you know, I come from filmmaking. I didn't get my master's. I have like 3 people on my team that got their master's, but they're of different flavors. And I knew, for example, that I really needed a true information architect who could actually dig deep into process and details. Like, you know, we few people that I know in this context can do. We needed someone who had a brain for, you know, strategies and systems of another kind. We have someone who's more of a top notch, like amazing interaction designer, and then someone who's, you know, at a different level. So I feel like, and another one who's very good about like thinking holistically about the system. So at the end of the day, we have a really balanced team of different strengths, and I think we have all the right strengths, which doesn't always happen.
So you get to work with some of the same people over and over again, or is it always flowing? Is it always changing?
Typically, in this context, you end up being embedded if you're a designer on an account.
So someone's embedded on Nike, and you work with them. And
yeah, so in this particular case, we have our team, the ones that I mentioned to you, are embedded in this account. And I'm hoping, if they ever listen to this, I hope they don't prove me wrong, but they'll be around for at least a year, because it requires so much of learning. It takes probably 3 months to ramp up to what we're doing, to really just understand the business process. And this is unusual. So I can't say this is always the case, but
no, I've never heard of I've heard of people working in-house, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I've heard of people, you know, and we at Happy Cog, we might have a, you know, a 2-year engagement with a mm-hmm. large client like the Holocaust Museum. But mm-hmm. but this sounds like it's been going on for 5-10 years with no end in sight.
Well, the relationship with Nike has been going on for 12 years.
Good this golly.
Yeah. So there is like that. It's tight. You know, I think as they change, we change. As we change, they change. And so it's a very unusual situation. But for this project, it's bigger than a project. It's a program for this global sales team. It's fairly new. It's 6 months old. It's probably going to go on for at least, they say they have a 3-year roadmap, but it's probably going to go on longer than that. And this is a case where we are as close to feeling like we're in-house as we can be. We're still remote, which is a downside, but
and an upside.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, we're remote, meaning they're 6-hour flight away, but we are literally,
you can work without them always over your shoulder.
Exactly.
And they can work without you constantly interrupting them to do more research. You know, you do research for a period and then you have to stop and work with what you got. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like a long distance kind of, you know, relationship, but so we made it work and we fly out there when we need to. But it's as close to feeling like you're in house and really working, rolling up your sleeves and working side by side with them, as opposed to servicing and revealing and, that's not our
approach.
It's
not ad agency.
No. Yeah. Not at all.
Before I was in whatever this is that I do, I was in advertising for a good while. And I was at agencies that would, not all of them, but I was at agencies that would mimic the hierarchy that the client had. So if the client had a junior account person and a senior and a mid senior, then we would have the same. And if they had 15 account people who did nothing, then we would have 15 account people. And basically the budget kept going up to match their, but you're not doing that.
No, I just see it. And I've seen that happen, but definitely not in this case. It's not like it's for sure not happening. I think part of having that long-term relationship has helped make it easier to engage with a new client within Nike on this particular project, because there's a built-in layer of trust that came with the new engagement, I think.
Have you always worked at the bigger studios?
No, I haven't. And that's interesting. This is probably the first big studio. I've always been a very independent, you know, I've never felt the need to pile on my resume with Google and Apple and stuff like that. I never thought of my career in that particular way. My career has been a little bit circuitous in to begin with, but I worked as a consultant for many years and sort of working with companies. And then coming from a creative background, when I transitioned to an agency, I thought, you know, that'll be interesting, because I think I might enjoy actually thinking not just about software, proprietary software for a business, but let's look at the bigger pictures, the storytelling and all that. So I started with a very, very small agency. That was my first agency job. And then it kind of went up the scale from there until I,
What was that little agency? Are they still around?
Oh, they are. They are. That's Roken. I think they were
downtown.
They're downtown in Soho. They were purchased by Publicis, I think, just recently.
Is that how you say that?
I'm not sure. Publicis? I think it's French. Publicis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, or something like that. But they just got, so they did really well. They've been around for about 10 years now. So, and then I did this, had another foray into an agency that was trying to become more of a digital agency.
Right.
And that was interesting because,
tough. It was,
even though I'd been warned not to take this job, and this is very funny. If you were listening, there's someone that, who used to work at RGA, who was working there, and he said, you probably don't want to work here. And in spite of that warning, I ended up taking the job because I thought,
you were the one that could change it. You were the one that could fix it.
My ego wouldn't be like that. It's more like, I would love to contribute and help, you know, help you find a path mm-hmm. and help you change or be one of those people to help.
And you had been a consultant leading up to that, and you were used to people actually paying attention to your recommendations. So you thought you could do that internally and it would work.
There would be a chance. They had good ideas. They didn't have the bad ideas. But again, it's we have management, leadership, clients that just find it really difficult to change. And it just was not an easy battle.
Right.
So, and then RGA was the kind of place where I was like, all right, there was already a culture that felt familiar. There was the people felt familiar. And it's like, okay, this feels more like the right mix of things. And there is a huge range of work going on in the context of a place. They've grown really fast, but they still feel like they have the DNA, the roots of that. There's the small place in which they started, which is kind of nice.
Do you teach? Mm-hmm. Have you thought about teaching?
I do. I love teaching. In fact, I've taught a lot over the years in various capacities. For the last 3 years, I was teaching interaction design at FIT. For anyone who's listening, you don't know, it's the Fashion Institute of Technology. It's a state university in New York, and it's basically an art school and a trade art school. They have fashion, they have graphic design, product design. And this happened to be in their computer animation and interactive media department. Mm-hmm. And it was their only interaction design class. And to give their students exposure to the practice. And that was great. This is the first year that I had to say that I couldn't do it. It would have been my fourth because I traveling too much and it just didn't work out with the class.
So. You travel a lot speaking.
And most of my travel lately has been to the client. Mm. And so that's required a lot.
They're in Portland?
In Portland, yeah. Yeah. So, so I love teaching and I hope that I can find my way back to another, other venues to do that.
FIT is awesome, but I hate their architecture. They're on 7th Avenue or 9th, 8th Avenue. I forget.
Yeah,
on the west side.
27th. It's like post-brutalist.
Post-brutalist. It was like, it's like Hitler and Mussolini got together and made something. And they said, no, there's still a trace of human warmth in that. There's still some sense that a human hand contributed to this. Let's just make these giant walls of stone, windowless.
Like it's like the 70s or something. That's what I seem to recall. There was some kind of like it's kind of modern, but.
I just saw Argo finally last night, which was awesome. But it was really great seeing the hair and clothes from the 70s and contextualizing them, right? As opposed to contextualizing them in kids smoking pot, contextualizing them in, the Iran hostage crisis and all. Mm-hmm. But that was also the time of that terrible, terrible architecture.
Yeah.
Just too bad. Some really good music.
Yeah. Just saved everything, I think.
Unfortunate Hair. Great music.
Oh, and great film. That is like the best decade ever for film, I think. One of the best.
Well, Wells, Hitchcock.
Hitchcock, I was going to say, I didn't win. There's also this. The 60s are pretty awesome, too. Yeah.
I agree with the... It's hard, like The Godfather and, what's not holding up very well? Star Wars.
Really?
It's kind of awful.
It's so funny. I've been watching some of the Star Wars with Alice, right? And I still think they're charming and great, but it's interesting. They do feel like, by today's standards, they do feel like quaint almost. I'm going to get in trouble with Star Wars fans right now.
I know, me too.
I can feel it.
Me too.
But,
well,
Ava
was critical.
She
really liked the middle movie because it was about family.
Oh, interesting.
She was like, so is Darth Vader going to turn good at the end? That's what she really wanted to know.
Yeah.
Kids this age seem to, they're really about redemption for some reason. They really like forgiveness and redemption. Yeah, they love those stories, and someone becoming a hero in the last 5 minutes.
You know what I showed Alice recently is E.T., I don't know why it took us so long.
I haven't seen that myself.
Oh, my God.
Can you believe that? I know.
It is just, it was she was sort of skeptical. And, you know, whenever we try and get her to show a movie that's older, that she, you know, it's like not animated. not always, but it's really beautiful. It's such a beautiful story. I mean, she was just captivated. I even saw her cry. Usually she's hitting me for crying in a movie, you know. And so it's a good one.
Yeah, the crying is the best.
Yeah.
When you're both crying. Toy Story 3. Toy Story 3. We saw it in the theater. We had to take our 3D glasses off when all the characters are going into the oven.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I was like, I was thinking, why did they make this for children and families again? I'm not sure. But, you know, luckily. But does film, your love of film, influence how you approach storytelling on the web or art direction on the web?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it probably, without me even thinking about it, I was trained first as a filmmaker. I was even in my first job for almost a decade, actually, was as a camera assistant and cinematographer. And I loved shooting. I loved the moving image and lighting and the textures and all of that.
So the visual more than the narrative.
No, actually not. So that was the first piece. But again, going back to my independent self, I was working in Hollywood and I felt like I wanted to do more independent. So I decided to go to New York and learn screenwriting so I could learn storytelling.
Mm.
Really learn it. So, and wanted to be able to, I've always liked to write, but like, you know, it's hard. I didn't have the confidence. You know, I wanted to learn the craft. And I focused on that.
Not the like five act hack thing of.
No.
I mean, what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Like 30 days and, you know.
The thing they're making fun of in adaptation.
Yeah. No. So interesting. That was probably even more formative because I used to design things. I come from a very visual background.
Right.
I used to draw and sketch. I don't do so much of it now, but I started to focus on writing. And that's where I felt like I was able to learn craft and understood what it meant to learn craft really well. A little bit.
Over and over again. I mean, to me, I wouldn't have the career I have. I don't even know if I'd have any career if I hadn't written.
Yeah.
It's so important. It's so important. You learn your ideas. You actually get to figure out what you think if you mm-hmm. write. Even just on a blog, even if two people read it, it doesn't matter. Just that discipline is so important. Mm-hmm. And the structure of thought, the structure of narrative, the structure of thought.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think what's interesting about screenwriting is it gives you think of different types of structures, right? There's the one sentence tagline boiling down your story. There's the short synopsis. There's the treatment. There's the outline. There's the script. And they're all different levels of telling the story. And you have to be able to communicate it in different ways. And you use some of those to get to the story. And then there's also just the craft of being able to construct a scene that works, that's real, that the, you know, the characters make sense. And that,
yeah, because it's still got to be magic, right?
Yeah.
It's still got to be that. That I'll believe those are real people talking. Not that they're advancing to the next plot point. You know, it's not exposition. It's they're just talking over lunch, but somehow it is advancing the story.
Right. And that's the hard part is like when you're writing, trying to make it real, trying to make it come from somewhere that feels authentic from a character's point of view, because if it's not, it's the first thing you're going to notice, right? When you're reading it. So
that's the worst part of Star Wars. The dialogue.
Well,
is just,
yeah, no, it's true. When you think about it, yeah, like the whole thing is awesome. But yeah, with, like when you look at that stuff, it does feel like a little clunky. But that, you know, back to your original question, I feel like it's one of the reasons I ended up picking up on information architecture because when I was in grad school, I needed a job, and I don't need to go deeply into that. But I was doing a number of things, information design. I taught software. And when one day I discovered information architecture and thought, oh my God, this is kind of like a screenplay in terms of the process, thinking through a problem. It's an organizing information. But I've always come at all of my design work, I think, from that storytelling perspective and have tried to sort of talk to, share this with teams because it's sort of like, what's the concept? Who's the audience? What's the narrative flow? How do you sequence things? All of that factors, I think, deeply into how I've always approached design. And it felt like it worked and kind of made sense. I mean, people approach it differently depending on where they come from.
Sure.
But it really has been pretty much of a foundation, I think, for the way I've thought about things. And it turns out it's really helped with strategy as well, I think.
Two other things with film. One is the Kuleshov experiment. Do you know that? It was where they, it was a Russian early, like, 20s. They proved that editing created thoughts in people's minds. They photographed an actor with a neutral expression.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed plates of food, and then they cut back to the actor, and people said, oh, he's so hungry. And they showed a woman undressing, and they said, oh, he's so lustful. And they just, different audiences saw the same neutral face of the actor. This was the whole basis of Hitchcock's art.
He
and the whole idea, and Disney did this too, that you could storyboard everything, and you could you could test before you had to start shooting that this visual plus this visual leads to this third thing, this idea in people's heads that isn't stated. And I think that is a huge thing for interaction design too, because we're constantly implicitly guiding people through an experience. Right.
I remember that. And those that was one of those things we, you know, studied and looked at in film school. But I completely agree, because there are there are learnings from that can be directly applied.
It's like headline and visual. Headline plus visual equals this third thing.
Yeah, right. Start with this, cut to that, you're going to get a response.
And what's boring on the web is when people, like, A equals A, right? When people take a visual that says the same thing as the words and put them together, and, you know, it's like, call us now, and there's someone with a headset, or planning your vacation, and there's someone on the beach, and it's like, you know what I mean? There's no, there's no creativity to the content, so...
Right.
Even if the grid's nice, right, and even if they've got nice other interactive things happening, there's still nothing really happening because the content sucks.
I would like to liken that to, there's an expression in film called progressive disclosure, and I think we even use that in the web.
We totally do.
Yeah, right?
We use it with forms, you know, with good form design, we use that.
But that is, it's interesting now because I'm wondering if that was, you know, even borrowed, but the idea of... how a certain sequence of shots would build tension and lead to a response in a final shot because of, again, just the way those things were. You'd see, in other words, in a murder mystery, it's more compelling not to just cut straight away to the shot of the dead body lying near the bed, but to see the hand hanging off the bed. Ooh, something's happened.
Right.
And it's already more compelling. And then you cut to the clock. And then you cut to the dripping blood. Okay, I'm over-dramatizing.
Okay.
I don't know why I thought of that example. But do you know what I mean? Instead of just going dead body in a murder mystery. So.
Or in the narrative, just when you find out, oh, he's double-crossing her. He's really a bad guy. You know, when you... In subtle movies where you suddenly realize that the character's really bad or you think they're bad and then you slowly realize they might be doing something good. I mean, you know, it's all that risk with the audience's allegiance and attention.
Right. So I know the word I was looking for. So I feel like there are techniques like that are both in filmmaking, like putting together the actual images, and in screenwriting for building tension, for, you know, a really craftful and someone who knows storytelling really well, I think, is able to actually construct something in a way that will generate a particular response, whether it's a laugh, whether it's shock, you know, and because there are techniques to doing that, not that they're, you know, different than five acts, you know, this is how we should do everything, but there are real techniques. And I've always wished that there were similar techniques that were more defined, that we could call upon, you know, beyond what we're already using for design, you know,
I think we spend a lot of time, as we should, make, you know, can I cut two steps out of this interaction, which will make it more likely that the person will finish you know, we'll complete their purchase or we'll sign the form or whatever it is that we're doing. We think about usability, accessibility, all that stuff's really important. All the things we think about are really important, but it would be nice to think more about, this is what I've been thinking about lately, being entertaining, being, you know, being delightful, being funny and unexpected.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think with Nike, you probably have the opportunity to do that a lot, right?
There's a voice there. And I think maybe, you know, on the consumer side, especially, I'm not particularly close to that, but.
Right. You're on the business side.
Yeah. Another thing I always think about related to that is also endings. And I don't think we think enough about endings. Like, where do you land? How do you, you know, resolve? And it's really important to feeling like closure, satisfaction, a certain, you know, and I think that that's something, you know, in an overall, because you can look at a flow sometimes as an arc, right? So, yeah.
Lots,
you got me thinking again.
Yeah, lots to think about. So, very interesting. I think we're getting, you know, we've used a lot of your time and we're getting near the time when we have to wrap up. People can find you on Twitter at C Chastain. That's not S-E-E, that's letter C Chastain. We'll have a series of links on my site and at 5x5. They can also read the IFC review of Loveless the movie and watch the movie on iTunes. I think it's great. And you have some stuff on LinkedIn, SlideShare.
Yep.
You don't have a huge web presence, which is puzzling to me.
Really?
I think you mostly do work, but it's not like you have a blog that I can, you know.
I have a blog that's been parked for like 4 years that I have. No, that I haven't. I honestly haven't had the time. People have said that. It's like, I can't believe you don't have a blog. And I'm like, yeah.
As well known as
you
are.
I have work. But still. You know, but one of these days.
The kid gives you the content for the blog, right? You don't have to write about interaction design.
No, that's true. I mean, I do have a list of subjects that I park in my Evernote. Like, all right, these are articles I want to write one day when I get to them. And maybe that will happen, but it's just honestly one of those things that I haven't been able to fit in. I love sharing, throwing ideas out there and getting feedback. And I get that through the conference, you know, thing. That's the one forum, but I'm even thinking maybe this is 2013 might be the year where it really is more about writing and putting that stuff out there. So,
yeah, well, you're learning things.
Don't hold me to it.
you're working on a kind of team that's different from what most of us work on a much longer engagement than most of us know who are in client services. So I'm sure, and you're doing small, you're running kind of a small team inside a big organization. So there's lots of stuff that you could be sharing. But, you know, if you don't blog, we'll just make you come back on the show again sometime.
Okay, good.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah,
thanks so much for having me. This is
a pleasure.
A blast.
Pleasure. Okay, take care.
All right, take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.